Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your emails and phone calls. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program don't represent the views of this station. They represent the views of the speakers, and the station's totally out of it, along with its employees and its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I'm going to start off with, there was so much interesting stuff this week that it's hard to know where to begin. But I think that the first place is probably that mental health that I saw tweeted and retweeted and retweeted over the week. By the way, if you want to follow my tweets, which I promise you are brief to the point and contain actual references, you can go to my website, askdrdawn.com, and just click on the follow me button. I also place longer posts on Facebook and am working to expand that. So you can encourage me by following. Anyway, so the issue is mainly about mental health, and what we're talking about is a report that came out saying that 1 in 5 Americans had had a mental illness in the last 12 months, or in a 12-month period, more accurately. Now, I was a little skeptical when I first saw this, because the data on something is only as good as the survey is. And how did they word it? Who did they ask? So it is posted, and we will post a link to it. It's actually a 120-page report. I didn't read the 120-page report. I read the synopsis. But essentially, they did a very good job of trying to design a survey that covered the population. So looking at that, the population distribution looked pretty good. They were very careful about language, and I liked the way they did the interview. It was an hour-long interview. They would go to a house and see, is there anyone there who will volunteer to do this? It's going to take an hour. It needs to be private. And they had a series of questions that were sort of neutral questions like, where do you live? Do you work? What's your health insurance? And then they had the sensitive questions about depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, et cetera. And those were asked by a computer. So the person would sit there and just, listen to the questions being asked by a recorded voice or read them on the screen at their preference, and then type in the answers or select from a box. I haven't seen the questionnaire, but that's the methodology. So I think that given the fact that there was no demographic data attached, and the interviewer made that clear, so the person's name wasn't hooked on to their responses, and the interviewer was not hearing or seeing your responses to the sensitive questions, I think they probably got pretty truthful answers. And that may account for why the number is so high. Effectively, what the study suggested was that many people, far more than we have thought, have had issues with mental health in any given year. And we need to start thinking in terms of fixing our rather broken healthcare system when it comes to mental health services. I struggle with this in our county on a daily basis. In California, and this may be true in other states, but in California, about a decade ago, mental health services were mandated by the Department of Insurance, which sounds like a really great idea. Ironically, it served to actually reduce access to mental health services because once it was mandated, the insurance companies had to provide it. So many more barriers now exist. Are you surprised? Well, remember that corporate bottom line. Anyway, at present, part of the dilemma I face is that almost all of the practitioners are full, at least part of the year, so it's hard to find someone accepting new patients. This is particularly true of psychiatrists. Secondly, most of the providers are not on all of the plans. And so often I'll get a list of people from the health plan, which, by the way, This is all administered through a centralized office at the health plan. It doesn't go through our local means of making referrals. So it's a whole different set of people and forms and things you have to fill out. It's a bureaucratic nightmare to get someone the help they need. And once you do, think about all those people who don't have health insurance. Think about all those people who don't have access to mental health services. And in general, those people in lower economic brackets who are between jobs, or the discouraged unemployed who aren't even counted in our unemployment statistics, those people are, well, let's just say they have life circumstances that are more likely to make them depressed. So 20% of the population? I think that's something we all need to think about. A couple of interesting emails, but I had at least four or five emails about the vitamin D and inflammation issue. So, of course, I went and looked at that information, and the study was published in the American Journal of Cardiology, and I will tweet a link to it. But it's one of these, on the yawn scale of medical importance, this study is definitely a 5/5. This is statistically significant, but completely meaningless from a medical standpoint. And it's all about orders of magnitude. So let me explain. This research, a well-done paper by what I can tell from the abstract, looked at the change in C-reactive protein, a marker for inflammation, and vitamin D levels, looking at the quartile and a regression analysis. And I'm going to get into just a little bit of technical stuff about statistics here. Regression analysis is where you plot two variables, one on the x-axis and one on the y-axis, and you see if you can draw a straight line between them. If you get a nice straight line with all of your data points, then that effectively means that there is some kind of connection and they're related in some way. It doesn't tell you which is cause and which is effect, but it tells you that these numbers tend to go up and down with each other. That's regression analysis. And there are ways of analyzing that and deciding whether it's statistically significant. Well, there is a regression analysis connection that is statistically significant with vitamin D, and it goes like this. If your vitamin D level is below 21 nanograms per milliliter, then as you supplement that person and give them more vitamin D, for every 10 nanogram change, you get a CRP change of 0.285, so a third of a point. So the lower it gets, the worse it is. There's an inverse relationship above that 21. So as you go up and get, say, 10 points higher, so from 21 to 31, you see a 0.06, very important, 0.06 increase in your C-reactive protein. So if I take my vitamin D level in my patient from 20 to 50, which is what I recommend for people with autoimmune disease, celiac, Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, et cetera, et cetera. If you take that level to 50, you will increase the C-reactive protein by a grand total of 0.18. Now, given that we care when it goes up by a full point, this is trivial. It has no increase in cardiovascular risk. This was published in a cardiology journal because cardiologists are interested in C-reactive protein. But this simply isn't on the order of magnitude. It makes a statistical difference, but it doesn't make a difference medically. And this happens all the time, where you get statistical significance, but from a clinical standpoint, it's a big ho-hum. And that's the circumstance with the vitamin D article. So I wanted to thank one of my emailers, and this was Caroline in, it looks like, Washington, who wanted to know about the alkaline diet. A friend of hers has cancer and is considering buying a machine that's supposed to improve your alkalinizes water, and that's supposed to be helpful for your cancer. And let's see. It's a water alkalinizing filtration system. That's all she says about it. Anyway, she gave me a reference to a really nice article. This was published in the Journal of Environmental and Public Health, Volume 212, and I will post a reference for this. This is a excellently done epidemiologic. It's a review published in this journal, looking at the evidence for the alkaline diet. What do we know? Where is it good? Where is it bad? And what's the data? I thought it was a very good review and well-referenced and sensible. So if you're interested in more information about this, because it's a big deal in health food circles and in natural medicine circles, this at least looks at the peer-reviewed data, which I think is always important. In answer to Caroline, before we go into a little bit about this alkaline acid thing, because I do have some opinions I'd like to share, your friend should go out and buy a box of bicarbonate of soda and some pH paper. And you can avoid the expensive alkalizing water filtration system because you can alkalize water really easy with baking soda, bicarbonate of soda. You start with a teaspoon and mix that into 8 ounces of water, and you simply are going to monitor how many alkalized glasses of water you need to drink, and you can make it stronger if you can stand it. So you measure how much you need to drink in order to change your urine pH. Now, if you change your diet and eat more fruits and vegetables, you'll change your urine pH. Dairy products and proteins, even beans for that matter, but certainly fish and chicken and red meat, all contain a lot of amino acids, and the amino acids are acids, so they acidify you. Your kidneys control your blood pH. So unless a person has severe kidney failure, the pH of their blood is going to be regulated very highly by their lungs and by their kidneys. And you aren't going to change blood pH by giving somebody bicarbonate. What you will change is their body load of alkali, and that will cause their body to put the alkali in the urine. And when you have alkaline urine, that's to say a pH above 7, many toxins remain in the urine and they don't get reabsorbed across the bladder wall. So it helps with detoxification. Certain chemotherapy drugs work better in an alkalized environment. And in fact, people are given bicarbonate intravenously at the time they're given these drugs. However, other chemotherapy drugs, and Caroline, this is important, other chemotherapy drugs actually do better in an acid environment. And I don't know the particular one that your friend is going to be using and what its characteristics are, but you can actually shoot yourself in the foot if you head in the wrong direction. This review does suggest something else. When you really look at just alkali, it doesn't have any cancer benefit that can be determined. And when you look at a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables, you have a large amount of confounding factors. Besides acting to alkalize the urine, fruits and vegetables contain a lot of compounds that independently have been shown to have profound effects on the growth of cancer cells and the initiation of cancers in the first place. So how can you separate the potentially just coincidental effect of making an alkaline urine with the potentially far more significant benefit of the bioflavonoids that are present in that diet? So bottom line, fruits and vegetables, not so much grain, and maybe if you still have a pH that is acid, it might not be such a bad idea to go ahead and drink a glass of bicarbonate water or two a day. By the way, mineral water, like fizzy water, also is an alkalizer for the urine. So I hope that clears that up. It certainly was a great article, and thank you to Caroline in Port Townsend, Washington, for bringing it to my attention. And here's a quick story that I found rather interesting. There's a new study that was published in China on internet addiction disorder. Yep, you can keep the drugs away, but you can't keep the internet away. And China has found that even by limiting what people can get to, they still are getting people who have addictive tendencies showing up with internet addiction disorder. Now, every new technology creates an opportunity for abuse. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, this study was looking at the MRIs of 18 adolescents all suffering from internet addiction disorder. And they found an impairment of the white matter fibers. In other words, they found a structural variation in these individuals. These were brain regions involved in emotion generation and processing, executive attention, decision-making, and cognitive control. Well, I don't know about you, but that sounds just about like everything. However, their research does suggest that there may be an actual anatomic variant that is associated with this. It'll be interesting to see whether that same anatomic variant that they've identified shows up in compulsive gambling, perhaps substance abuse disorders, and I'd be really interested in those sorts of tic disorders, things that people do to themselves over and over and over again, and whether or not that also creates an issue. Here's a little cautionary tale. Researchers were Well, let's just say that it's a good thing that we test things on rats before we test them on humans. Researchers had a good idea. This is the Division of Matrix Biology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and professors at Harvard Medical School. And their idea was that since targeting angiogenesis, the growth of blood vessels, is so important in cancer control, maybe we could target the cells of the blood vessels in some way. So what they did was create mice with a mutation. You can just order up mice now. It's so amazing. You just decide what you want them to be and then order them up and they send you the mice with the particular mutation. It's not quite that simple, but almost. And so they ordered up mice that were genetically engineered to have a switch that was drug-induced that would deplete the pericytes. Pericytes are the supporting cells of the blood vessel wall. So they could give the mice breast cancer, mouse breast cancer, and then hit them with the drug and drop the pericyte numbers. And what they found was that the cancers grew much more slowly in the mice whose blood vessels had been damaged by depletion of the pericytes. Well, that was a good thing. Let's fast forward about 30 days, and they noticed that the mice that got this treatment that had the small tumors had way more metastasis. Oops. Turns out that when you cut off the blood supply to a tumor or reduce it, you create a state of anoxia or stress. Evolution steps in, and the tumor cells themselves are pushed to mutate, and they de-differentiate, which is, by the way, always bad in cancer. They go into what's called an epithelial to mesenchymal shift. They turn on their mesenchymal DNA. That's earlier, that's DNA from when you're an embryo, and de-differentiate. As a result, the weakened blood vessels plus these cells, which are now pluripotential and can jump through the weakened blood vessel wall and get into the system, and they can move, they can migrate, they can stick somewhere else and act like stem cells and grow. So you got, yes, smaller tumors, but oops, more metastasis. This rings to mind just the cautionary idea that when you mess with things at a genetic level, you're going to have the law of unintended consequences. And one last story, at least for the moment, about that law of unintended consequences. Researchers were studying, and we talked about this last month, a form of bird flu, the H5N1. Perhaps you'll remember years and years ago, there was outbreaks of bird flu in Asia and Hong Kong. And in fact, we had a problem so severe that they massively killed off birds and ducks all over Asia to stem this because a few humans actually got this bird flu and died. It was a very aggressive flu when it got into them. And there was one case where they thought there might have been a human-to-human transmission, but that was it, just one case. And it didn't take off, thank goodness. But researchers, scientists, and I'm sorry, ivory tower types who just aren't thinking through and didn't see Jurassic Park, obviously, were working on this H1N1, trying to make it airborne. And they just kind of accidentally discovered that, yes, indeed, if you keep giving it from one ferret to another, it takes only about 3 mutations to change this virus into a virus that is respiratory. Now, it's respiratory in ferrets, mind you, but we all know how species jumps occur. So taking something that is not respiratory and making it spread by sneezing, especially when it's a potentially lethal virus, is not such a good idea. So the American National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity actually asked the journal Science and Nature to censor details of the papers. And actually, the papers have not been published. And in fact, the researchers themselves have gotten together and voluntarily agreed to suspend the research for 60 days while they think through the implications of doing this. I want to add also that this research is being done in a biosecurity level 3 lab. So that means that the researchers have to shower and change clothes. They also have negative air pressure, and they pass exhaust through high-efficiency air filters. They use tables when they're working with the virus that will suck up the air so that they don't breathe in the virus particles. But it's kind of a low level of security when you're dealing with a respiratory virus. Ebola, SARS, things like that, which, if you ask me, this virus is just as potentially dangerous as SARS or Ebola, perhaps even worse because it will potentially spread and kill more people than an outbreak of those will. effectively, if they go back to doing this research, I hope that they'll be doing it in the kind of hot zone suits with air supplies so that the researchers themselves are not going to inadvertently pick up the virus and vector it outside, which could certainly happen in this circumstance if that respiratory virus turns out to be something that can jump from ferret to human. And we're going to our first caller, and that is David in Monterey. Hello, David. Welcome to the show.
I don't want to open up a whole stuff you don't want to talk about, but I've just started going to AA, and I'm just asking your medical opinion of their program, if you want to comment on it. And if not, that's fine.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm happy to comment on AA. Alcoholics Anonymous has been around for a very long time and is the sort of original 12-step program. In fact, the 12 steps come from it. It was founded by a couple of people who were alcoholic and trying to stop. I don't remember what year this was. Perhaps you know. And many, many clinical studies have been done over the years looking at the success rates and what the features are of a successful program. And AA kind of nailed them all. It is a group where people support each other. Some of the features that appear to be the most important for AA are having a sponsor, having a relationship with someone to whom you are able to go to when you're tempted, who will talk you out of it or remind you of the reasons why you don't want to drink. Another feature that appears to be key in success rate and has been replicated all over the place is the idea of some sort of daily affirmation, which is key, and going to daily AA meetings represents that affirmation. The affirmation should be a little bit difficult. It doesn't have to be super difficult, but it has to be enough of an effort that you don't want to waste that effort. I liken it sometimes to what happens when people are losing weight on a weight control program. They get jealous of their success. I see the same thing in people who are diabetics who start changing their diet and they start having better glucose scores and they get jealous of that success and it makes them think of that cookie or donut a little bit differently. And that's what happens with AA. It changes the psychological cost of taking that first drink. And it's a slippery slope with most alcoholics, particularly after they've trained themselves, their brain changes and things like the sight and smell of alcohol, the environment where they drink, all act as triggers. The AA creates a large behavior change and an investment in getting through the day successfully without drinking. Hence the phrase, one day at a time. Celebrating the successes, even small successes, a week without drinking, a day without drinking, creates another sort of reward cycle in the brain and over time is very helpful in sustaining sobriety. And also just when you've successfully gone through a program like AA, one of the psychological devices that people have is to become sponsors. That's like being a parent. You have a responsibility not just to yourself and your loved ones, but also to the people for whom you are being an example. And that has additional psychological power. It picks up other circuitry in our brains, the responsibility and nurturing circuitry, and helps sustain the sobriety through that pathway.
So it's a kind of a combination of a psychological and a physical situation.
Most addiction is primarily psychological. The first part of it, getting through your withdrawal, that's a very short period of time. What sustains the alcoholism are the behavior loops, the psychological, if you will. Psychological is such a broad term that think in terms of habit and behavior that have become intrinsic, like the way someone who was in a war zone ducks when they hear a backfiring. It's not a voluntary decision. It's happening at the rat or the worm level of the spinal column.
Well, they seem to stress the physical aspects of it, but I guess it doesn't make a lot of difference. Like, whatever works, works. You know?
Tell me about the physical aspects that they stress.
Well, they say that people are programmed, some people are programmed genetically and psychologically both.
There isn't,
as alcoholics.
Yeah, that's what we call a false dichotomy. Excuse me for interrupting you. I see your point. But you see, I don't think of genetics, when they are genetics that affect brain function, as physical. You know, I think of that as brain physiology, which is the same thing as psychology.
They're blended together.
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, in alcoholism, in the genetics, what we see is a couple things. We see a change in the way the body breaks down alcohol. The alcohol dehydrogenase gene is different. And this is particularly true of ethnic groups like Asians and American Indians.
Who, right.
And so that's physical genetic into the liver. And then you have the physical genetic that goes into the brain and determines how these reward pathways are set up and how easy it is to set them up. And the genetics for alcoholism correlate closely with dopamine levels and thresholds and feedback loops in the reward pathways. And people with this DNA also have a tendency towards other kinds of substance abuse, sexual addiction, gambling addiction, internet addiction. So, and that white matter that was abnormal on the MRI that we talked about a little while ago, well, probably there are other physical, actually physical measurable, you can take a picture of it with the right instrument, changes in the brain that grow with prolonged alcoholism. And so the question is then, okay, you've got, your brain is set up this way, you have to avoid the triggers and you have to fight these biases. They may have been there genetically, potentially, but they aren't triggered till you start drinking. So I've got patients who have lots of alcoholism in their family who simply decided when they were 12 years old, I'm never taking a drink, and they don't drink, and they don't have alcoholism. If they started drinking, you know, they might develop it, and they'd certainly have a higher risk.
It's a complicated issue, obviously. Can I ask one more quick question?
Yeah, sure.
I talked to you 2 or 3 weeks ago. My brother claims he's got level stage 4 lung cancer, and he claims that he has been taking this drug called Miracle Minerals. And I think I asked you if you'd ever heard of it, and I said no.
And I said that whenever you hear the word miracle, you should worry.
Well, it sounds like a bunch of the usual stuff, but it's not expensive. And it's a blend of a normal, yeah. I don't know what exactly what the drug is, but it's not like one of these things where it costs you, you know, $500 a month or $100 a month. It's like $30 a month.
Well, it's still $30
a month. And he claims it shrunk his lung cancer down to nothing.
Well, that is wonderful, but I'm really skeptical. And so,
well, okay.
There's nothing else I could say. I think that, you know, we do see spontaneous remission. Sometimes maybe it is possible that for that particular person at that particular time, all they needed was a little extra magnesium. But I'm skeptical. Understanding the physiology of cancer, I'd be more inclined to think he was misdiagnosed or someone screwed up the x-ray films, you know? Anyway, I'm a skeptic on that.
I'm with you there, but
just smile and say hallelujah, God bless you, what a wonderful thing to have happened. Now God has saved you for a reason, and you need to figure out what it was.
There you go. Okay.
And he won't want to talk to you anymore after that, because you've given him responsibility, which he probably won't like.
Thanks a lot. You got a great show.
Bye-bye. We had an off-air question about, do I know anything about microwaves affecting food molecules and having health effects? Microwaves heat water, so of course it's going to denature proteins and change the nutritional value in the same way that cooking or boiling or steaming food would. And there have been plenty of studies looking at seeing whether it somehow creates a unique change in the food that would make it more dangerous, and none of those have panned out. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Jamie in Santa Cruz. Hello, welcome to the program.
I have a number of questions relating to the mental health study. I'm an interested therapist.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to market myself in a new area. So I have three questions straight off. One is, did the study itself ask people if they had sought help and what was the result? Secondly,
yes.
Well, let me ask you that first, and then I'll ask you a follow-up question.
Yeah, yes, they did.
And the result?
They also tracked whether they had access, whether they sought help and got it, whether they sought help and didn't get it, and whether they thought they had improved. I don't have that data. As I said, it's a 120-page report, and I didn't read the whole thing, but I'll post a link to it.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'd like you to comment on two other questions. One is, do you find it true that many doctors and psychiatrists do not refer people to therapists by name to make the access easy to get them into treatment?
I think that the answer to that is I try to do it, and the way my current strategy, and this is what my partners and I all do, I can't speak for other offices, is we ask the person to get a list from their health plan of funded providers. And then I look at that list and I circle names and I say, okay, this person I've worked with, I can vouch for them. This person has expertise in grief and bereavement, so that's great because that's your issue. And so I try to give some guidance, but because of the problem in our community with practices being closed and the insurance issue, I don't want to set things up by saying, oh, go see, let's say your name's Jamie. So go see Jamie Brown. He's great. And then it turns out that the person can't see Jamie Brown because he's not on the health plan. And now anybody else that person sees is second rate, you know, because their doctor told them they should go see Jamie Brown. And I don't want to set that one up.
Right. A fair number of people can't afford therapy without insurance. I'm just curious. So you try to refer. Is it your understanding, as it is mine, that many doctors actually do not recognize many symptoms as psychological, for instance, for behavioral problems, that they, in fact, don't refer them?
I think it's true that we don't refer as much as we should. Part of the reason is we get these really hostile letters from patients when we suggest that whatever issue that they are coming to us for medically might actually be helped by psychological issues. People get very insulted and offended. Now, they shouldn't, but they do. And it's a really great way to lose a patient. You have to be really careful about how you approach this issue. And many people just reject the concept entirely and fire you if you bring it up. So,
yeah, and I agree with that. I've never had a man voluntarily come to me in 16 years. Men, with all due respect to them, and I'm one of them, seem to come only if a woman in their life, a mother, whatever, does bring them in. Mm-hmm. At least that was my experience treating the poor for 16 years.
Yes.
I'm interested, though, that when I contacted 20 psychiatrists by phone, and I'll follow up in different ways now, none of them called me back. And all I was trying to do was to set up a referral relationship. So I'm a little worried about where the snag really is here.
Mm-hmm. I can't speak to that one. That's a very interesting point. And I would invite any psychiatrists out there who are listening or anyone who would perhaps be related to a psychiatrist to ask them to listen to this and respond next week, because maybe we do have an issue that I'm not aware of.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Jamie. And good welcome to our town and good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. And we're going now to Robin in Watsonville. Hello, Robin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn. I have a question today that's related to celiac disease.
Go ahead.
It seems in our family that we have some people that have allergies to wheat or celiac. Okay. One, my son-in-law has tested positive for celiac, and we know that he and my daughter's kids, my grandkids, also have a lot of allergies and allergies to wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And when we discovered that first, the allergies and the kids. And then when we removed the wheat from the diet of my grandsons, then what happened was they developed an allergy to rice.
Mm-hmm. Very young. So what is your specific question about this?
Since my son-in-law has tested positive for celiac, I also have wheat allergies. So I've been off of wheat for a long time. My grandkids have been off of wheat for a number of years now. You know, they say in order to get tested for celiac, you have to go back on wheat. Well, I'm not really interested in going back on wheat.
We don't want to
put the kids back on wheat. Is there some other testing?
It's a misunderstanding. Okay, so are we trying to answer the academic question of does this person have celiac disease? Or are we trying to answer the practical clinical question of does this person do better when they avoid wheat? Because those are two very different things. Celiac is the tip of the iceberg. It's when a person, because of their unique DNA, they have to have either a DQ2 or a DQ8 HLA antigen, which is, I call it the barcode on your cells that tells the immune system what's what. If you have one of those two antigens, you are eligible to develop celiac disease, which typically shows up in people who are eating a lot of wheat and under stress, and their immune system suddenly starts attacking the wheat antigen, thinking that it's a foreign invader. This is far more common in families where allergies are a tendency, because allergies themselves are a mistaken identity by the immune system. So you've already got the tendency. Okay, it's also more common in people who have some kind of damage to the intestine from maybe too much aspirin, or maybe they get a parasite or something like that, because then they've lost their barrier, like the blood-brain barrier. You have a gut barrier, And when that gut barrier is weakened, more antigen, more barcodes get across where the immune system can see them. And it looks like, to the immune system, a bacterial invasion trying to get into the bloodstream. So it attacks. So that's the basic thing that's going on physiologically. And celiac is a particular antigen, gliadin, which is a breakdown product of gluten. Gluten is found not just in wheat, but in other compounds. Over the last 20 years, we've deliberately increased the gluten content of food because it makes bread nice and chewy, and we like that chewy taste. And so we've bred for high gluten wheat, and that's what is in our diet. That may be a factor in why this is on the upswing. But you can develop antibodies against other components of wheat. So you can be celiac negative. You can test negative and still have wheat sensitivity. If you're trying to exclude celiac, like you want to make sure that the person, let's say the grandsons, okay, so you want to know whether or not they could develop celiac disease. I mean, they've obviously got wheat sensitivity, and right. when you fed them a lot of rice, they got rice sensitivity. So now you want to know, okay, what do we do with these kids? I would get the antigen testing. If they do not have DQ2 and they do not have DQ8, then yes, they're going to have food sensitivity issues, but they aren't going to develop full-blown celiac. So at least you'll know that, and you'll also know that you don't have to be a complete Nazi when they go to school.
And what kind of test would show that?
It's an HLA antigen test for DQ2 and DQ8. And that sounds like gobbledygook, but and your doctor will probably not have a clue about it unless they're well-read. And
okay.
if your doctor knows about that, then three cheers for your doctor because they're actually keeping up, not just reading the pre-digested pablum that comes through the American Academy of Family Practice Journal, which is...
So,
you know, with all due respect, not very sophisticated.
So, Dr. Dawn, related to this is the doctor's suggestion was that my grandson go on a 5-day rotation diet because he's already developed an allergy to rice,
mm-hmm.
and we, you know, substituted rice for the wheat.
That's a good idea. How old is this child?
He's 8.
Okay. Yeah. Not eating the same thing every day, number one. Number two, this kid needs probiotics, vitamin D levels, maybe some gut restoration. There's something wrong with his intestine that is allowing him to get large doses of antigen into his bloodstream and react to it. So, well, not into his bloodstream, but I'm being too technical here.
So there's some other causes that could be aggravating this.
This is a multifactorial condition, and you can address some of these other factors, but changing the diet and shifting it around so that he doesn't see large amounts of any particular antigen is a really good idea.
Okay, so when they suggested the 5-day rotation diet, they suggested that he eat the same grain for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then go to the next day and eat a different grain for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Is that still potentially overdoing it?
I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, okay.
It's too specific, and I don't know enough details about this child to be able to rationally answer it. That might be okay.
Okay.
There's a really good interview with Gerard Mullen on our website, on the archives. It's June 13th, 2009, and it's at askdrdon.com. So I'd recommend that as required listening for your family. You can
okay.
go to the archives, go to my website, askdrdon.com, click on the archives, look, search for Gerard Mullen, you'll find it. And that's the June 13th, 2009. Okay? Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. We had an off-air comment. Caller knows someone who uses L-glutamine to help gut problems. And yes, indeed, I too recommend the use of L-glutamine for people with gut problems. But again, this is a dynamic. It's not something that we can do by just throwing L-glutamine into the mix. You need to fix the intestine in a more sophisticated way. But it wouldn't hurt to throw L-glutamine in at a dose of about 5,000 milligrams a day. Get the powder and scoop it and mix it in with yogurt or something. The pills are ridiculous. You have to take 10 to 12 pills to get a dose that's meaningful. Let's go now to April. Hello, April.
Hello.
Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. I'm calling today because I recently stopped taking citalopram, which is the generic for Celexa.
Yes.
And I had been on it for a couple of years, and I've been wanting to go off of it. And then my prescription ran out, so I was like, oh, I just won't get it filled. And so I stopped cold turkey. And ever since then, I've been feeling really rageful and angry. And I started taking some 5-HTP and GABA.
Good.
And I was wondering, how long does it take? I'm experiencing some dizziness and a lot of mood fluctuations. And so I'm wondering, how long does it take to get over that?
It's usually about a month. How long have you been off of it?
Just like 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, so it's usually about a month.
Uh-huh.
You could probably, at this point, go back on it at half strength and erase most of those symptoms, and then in a week, go down to quarter strength.
Uh-huh.
And that's usually how I have people do it, drop it down by about 25% a week.
Uh-huh.
But since you've already been off of it for 4 or 5 days, I wouldn't go back to 75%. I'd go to 50%.
Okay.
And it's easier to manage. You could just continue doing what you're doing and ride it out, you know, meditate, and the GAB is not a bad idea. Some of that probably does get in across the blood-brain barrier. A lot of it doesn't, but I do think GABA actually works for some people. And the 5-HTP, again, that'll raise your serotonin levels. But that's very simplistic. It's kind of like having a bowl, and from across the room, you throw a bag of flour and you throw a bag of sugar at the bowl and you expect cookies to come out.
Oh.
You know, the brain's really complicated. And maybe you'll get something that you can bake out of that, but it's about that random.
See, I read on Wikipedia that 5-HTP is used in Europe for major depression.
That's correct, because it is a precursor to serotonin, and
uh-huh.
it's also used here in natural medicine circles for the same reason. The idea uh-huh. is that if you give enough precursor, enough of the building block, you'll get more of the output product. That may be true in some people, but let me give you my favorite metaphor for this. I keep my house with a wood stove. It'll hold 2 logs at a time. I have 25 logs stacked by the wood stove, but I can't get the house any hotter. Because I can, right? It's only going to hold 2 logs. It doesn't matter how many I've got stacked up. And that's the, with 5-HTP is the logs. And the heat is the serotonin.
Ah, I see. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Let's do another email. This one from Susan in Salinas. My 22-year-old son just received results for a complete metabolic panel and a CBC. He had the testing done last summer after being extremely ill. He has 3 abnormalities, and she lists them, the AG ratio, the total bilirubin, and the mean corpuscular hemoglobin. And all of these are just slightly high. And she's worried about impaired liver function. That bilirubin has got her worried. How long will it take the levels to return to normal, assuming healthier behavior on his part? So let me just say that, first of all, if I'm looking for liver damage from alcohol, I want to look at GGT. And that is not done on our local regular liver panel. You have to order it specially. But GGT, which is gamma glutamyl transferase. Anyway, GGT is a very sensitive marker for alcohol-induced liver damage and also for viral hepatitis. But that's the one that'll be up after drinking too much over the weekend. And all the other liver enzymes, including the bilirubin, will be just fine. So I don't think your son's elevated bilirubin, which is only mildly elevated, means anything about alcohol. The only thing I see that could be related is the elevated mean corpuscular hemoglobin. When I see a high MCH, I want to know, is the MCV high? If the MCV, which is the mean corpuscular volume, is high, then you want to worry about B12 deficiency and folate deficiency. So I hope that's helpful for you, Susan. And I'm glad that your son has straightened out his behavior and is no longer drinking to excess. Another email, we're going to use Joyce in Carmel. And Joyce has fibromyalgia, been managing it for 24 years, but she has the migraine headache variation. And it's really debilitating, really bothered her. She's tried many treatments. She says, I'm under the wise direction of my doctor, who encourages treatments of yoga, meditation, tai chi, massage, and acupuncture, as well as a year-long tapering off my hormone replacement therapy. Premenopause was the migraine trigger, and the fibromyalgia keeps it cycling. Trying these modalities offers empowerment, and she wants to know about Bowen work, which unfortunately, Joyce, I haven't really had a chance to review what Bowen work is or whether I think it could be helpful for you. If it's not charging you an arm and a leg to learn it, I guess it's worth a try. But I did want to put your call out because of Feverfew. Parthenolide, a compound that's in an herbal substance called Feverfew, is a very helpful drug for migraines. It takes about 3 months of daily use before you see the attenuation of migraines, but I found it very helpful. And you can buy high-quality Feverfew in extract form, and I'm hopeful that that will be beneficial. The other thing I wanted to say is that conventional medicine has a number of excellent drugs that can be at low doses very effective for migraine prevention. So you want to explore what's called prophylactic therapy for migraines. You can look that up in Wikipedia and read about the drugs, but some of them can be really very good. Some of them are blood pressure medicines and some of them are seizure medications, and they seem to stabilize the nerves that trigger the vasospasm that leads to the migraine. So it's worth looking into prophylactic therapy, either herbal or pharmaceutical. Just checking the time here. We have time for several more emails. John in Monterey writes, I've been taking fish oil for years. In the subsequent time, I've repeatedly tested high for triglycerides between 200 and 600. I don't recall having high triglycerides before taking fish oil. I was prescribed Lavasa, which has a $140 copay, and I did my research and find that Lavasa is a form of fish oil. It's not the natural triglyceride form. It's combined with ethanol, which removes the glycerol background and reduces the boiling point so it can be purified at lower temperatures. This process is known as molecular distillation. This leaves the end product a fatty acid ethyl ester, which can be converted back to triglycerides using enzymes, but this process is rarely done. The majority of fish oil on the market is in the fatty acid form, not the triglyceride form. One can test their fish oil type by using a polystyrene cup. I didn't know this. Thank you for the tip, John. If you put your fish oil in a polystyrene cup, the ethyl ether form of it will eat through it much faster, about 10 minutes, versus the triglyceride, which takes 2 hours to leak through the cup. So that's interesting and certainly a good little tip. My confusion with triglyceride is my inability to understand why a high triglyceride level is treated by administering a triglyceride, or in the case of FAEE, a precursor to a triglyceride. Also, what do you estimate the efficacy of the FAEE form is versus triglyceride? So I wanted to put out a first statement. John, you may have one of two things going on, most likely. You have a hereditary mutation in how your body handles fat that leads to slow processing and a buildup of triglycerides in your system. It would also be in your parents or your parents' parents or your siblings, so you might ask around about that. The other thing I want to say is that when I see a high triglyceride, I always check a hemoglobin A1C to make sure that the person does not actually have elevated insulin levels. If their A1C is above 5.7, then high insulin levels could be contributing to the high triglycerides, and you treat that with, paradoxically, not a low-fat diet, but a low-starch diet. So that's an important variable to identify, is what's the source of your hypertriglyceridemia. And certainly with levels of 200 to 600, it does represent a cardiac disease risk. Other things that lower triglyceride, you can use gemfibrozil, which is Lopid. There's a drug called Tricor. These are fibrates, and they will lower triglycerides. So that's another pharmaceutical strategy. I think the copay, particularly for the generic gemfibrozil, is much more reasonable. In terms of Lavasa versus the other forms of triglycerides, you're worrying about $140 copay. You can go out and buy the Nordic Naturals liquid triglyceride. It's $30 for a 20-day supply. You can get, in other words, fish oil that is in the triglyceride form, over-the-counter, better quality than the Lavasa in terms of its effectiveness. And the only reason I ever prescribe Lavasa is when a patient literally has a really good set of insurance and they don't want to spring $50 a month for fish oil. They'd rather pay $10 a month for Lavasa. And in that circumstance, yeah, okay, I'll write for the Lavasa. But I actually think the only superiority it has to the natural product is the fact that it's covered on insurance plans because the company bothered to go ahead and make it a pharmaceutical. This is Dr. Dawn Motyka, and I want to thank you for listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. So long, stay healthy, and come back next week for more of Ask Dr. Dawn. And please visit the website, AskDrDawn.com, where you can look at archives of old shows. You can also look at our resources. We've got a lot of interesting links. And always, of course, encouraging you to follow me on Twitter and Facebook. So long, and stay healthy.